And welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran, Managing Editor for News at WCAI, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is reporter George Brennan of the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Hello, George.
Good morning, Sean.
Thanks for being here. Joining us a little later will be Tim Wood. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. And Joshua Balling will join us from the newsroom at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. And we'll hear from Nelson Siegelman, managing editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. And let's take a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands and the South Coast. George, we've been following a theft of oysters and some equipment associated with oysters, actually a major theft, and there was a break in that case.
Yeah, this, of course, happened last summer, and there were thefts all over the Cape Shores in Dennis and other areas. It was a mystery. Who was stealing these oysters? And it was such a mystery that some of the people got together and put together a reward. They wanted to find out who this culprit was. And it took months and months of investigation. And there was a major break in the case a couple of months ago, mm-hmm. and it was sort of a mystery. They said that they were about to indict someone, and it took a couple of more months. And just this past week, there was an indictment in the case, and it was this local man, Michael Bryant, was indicted by a Barnstable County grand jury on 6 counts of larceny of property and various shellfish violations. What surprised everybody is there was another person implicated in this, and that was Joseph Votto. He's a 62-year-old sandwich man. He owns Joe's Lobster Mart right there on the canal.
Right.
It's a big fish market. Lots of people go there. And he was apparently, he pled guilty to receiving stolen property. He was buying the oysters from this guy.
Mm. Yeah, I think some of the concern was it among oyster farmers was, this could be one of our own who's done this to us.
That's right. It was a major concern. And another major concern was some of these were coming from contaminated shellfish beds.
Right.
And so they're, you know, the oyster farmers know which ones they can sell and which ones they can't sell. And in this case, some of them were coming from places where, you know, you couldn't make sure that they were safe.
Sure.
You know, so people could have gotten sick from this. And I know people haven't seen the paper maybe today in some parts, and I do apologize on behalf of the paper that it's late delivered today, but there was a letter to the editor in the paper from a customer of the fish market saying she's really upset because, you know, she supported this fish market for years. He had some struggles with the Army Corps of Engineers at one point who wanted to take away his lease there on the canal, and he was supported. And they feel like they were left out to dry by him. They buy their stuff from him and they count on him. And so people are upset about it.
And he could face some additional sanctions?
That's what they're saying. I mean, you know, you never know until it happens, but there is some risk that he could face further charges.
Okay. George, you've been spending the past few weeks in Barnstable Superior Court covering the trial of John Rams Jr., who was accused of murdering a Falmouth woman. Tell us about that case and the results of that case that as the verdict was handed down this week.
Well, in 2005, Shirley Rainey of East Falmouth was murdered, and it was really a mystery who did it. There was no physical evidence at the scene, no gun, no bullets, no fingerprints. Investigators looked at this case for years. They finally indicted John Rams Jr. in 2011. They indicted him. They believed he was hired to shoot her. And the trial was this past 2.5 weeks. And on Wednesday, a 12-member jury found him not guilty. And one of the jurors, as they left the building, called it just a horrible case. Hmm. They said that the prosecution just didn't connect the dots for them. Prosecutor Brian Glennie said in his opening arguments, he said, this is going to be a puzzle, and you're going to have to piece together the evidence. He asked them to be patient with him. And in his closing, he tried to bring him back and say, I told you it was going to be a puzzle, but now you can look at the picture, and the picture leads to John Rams. They didn't buy that. Hmm. It was an interesting case. There were some revelations about some long-standing unsolved crimes in East Falmouth during the trial. There were, as there are in any trial, there were ebbs and flows. But I guess what really stuck out to me is that there's this long history with the Rainey family in East Falmouth, and much of it, the questions still aren't answered. There are still so many outstanding questions, and this just leaves more. John Rams Jr., not guilty. Loretta Guilfoyle was in the room, in the courtroom at the time of the verdict. She's the sister of Shirley Rainey. She was sobbing. You know, yeah. She thought she was finally going to get some sort of closure in this case.
Reading your coverage, the district attorney seemed to indicate that there could perhaps be another trial and more charges against someone else in the future. What is he talking about there?
Well, in a murder case, there is no statute of limitations.
Right.
These cases sometimes can be solved 20, 30 years down the road. And we've seen that here on Cape Cod recently with a Buzzards Bay case. So he's saying that this case will remain open.
But it couldn't be John Rams Jr. again. You can't be tried twice.
No, it couldn't be John Rams Jr. again. You know, the evidence pointed toward Todd Rainey. He's the stepson of Shirley Rainey. He's suspected. He's been listed in court documents, in police reports, as a suspect in this case. He has never been charged. I want to make that clear. That Todd Rainey's never been charged. But he and his brother were embroiled in a bitter lawsuit with Shirley Rainey when she was murdered. The case was scheduled to go to trial within 2 weeks of her murder. The case was over family property. It was over the trash hauling business. Todd Rainey wasn't happy with her. She had sold a car that he thought was his, that his father had given to him.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And she sold it. He actually bought it back for more money from the place she sold it to. He wasn't happy. The mother of his two children lived on what they call the Rainey compound. There are three houses there in East Falmouth. She lived in one of them, rent-free, based on an agreement with his father. Well, when his father went away to Taunton State Hospital, Shirley Rainey went to her and said, "I want you to start paying rent." You know, the finances weren't as good as Melvin Rainey Sr., would have let people to believe, and she needed money to help keep the business going, and so she went to this woman and said, "I need you to start paying rent." That never happened. You know, so there were all these dynamics.
And did the defense attorney really grab onto these and put them in front of the jury?
He did. He did. The defense attorney was Timothy Flaherty, and, you know, he really made his case that there was more to this. He also, in a bit of theatrics during the trial, Todd Rainey Jr., I'm sorry, his name's Todd Rainey. He's not Todd Rainey Jr. Todd Rainey was there at the courthouse. He had been called as a potential witness, mm-hmm. but he pleaded the fifth. And that happens behind closed doors, so nobody knows why he pleaded the fifth against self-incrimination. But he decided to stay and watch the trial for a little while. And he was up in the balcony. He was actually sitting right next to me up in the balcony. And Timothy Flaherty had someone in the stand, and he said, "Do you know Todd Rainey?" The witness said, "No, I don't know Todd Rainey." And he pointed up into the balcony, and he said, "So you don't know that man up there?" And it was a brilliant move because the jury saw at that moment that Todd Rainey, who all the evidence seemed to point to, was a free man. And John Rams Jr. was sitting there on trial.
Sounds like a lot of drama in the courtroom. And from what the district attorney is saying, maybe we're going to hear more about this case going forward. Let's talk about new drug policies being applauded, not just on Cape Cod, but across the state. The governor seems to be taking very seriously the opiate problem, the heroin problem in the Commonwealth, and it's actually affecting local police departments.
Yeah, a lot of advocates looked at this, and we're very pleased with what the governor came up with. He is put attention to the problem, first of all, but he's also committing $20 million towards it. One of the people that we've spoken to over the years said she had tears in her eyes when she heard this news, that finally some state money is going to be put toward this specific problem. And probably even bigger in many of their minds is that he committed to banning a drug that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved. It's pretty controversial. There are concerns that that was going to further the problem.
It's a new opiate-based prescription painkiller.
That's correct. And a lot of people point to the current problem we have now, point back to the early 1990s when OxyContin was approved and became such a widely used pain reliever, mm-hmm. you know, for many different things. And people get addicted to it. And then eventually it turns them to heroin, which is cheaper. We also had a Sunday story, and I tweeted this, that I think it should be a must-read for any family. So if you have last Sunday's paper, go back and look at it. You can look it up online. But we had a story about this individual family and this young man who overdosed and nearly died. And, you know, the story's heartbreaking because he had so much going for him. He had he was a talented baseball player, but beyond that, he was a great student. And now he lives a much different life. And
he was left with brain damage after an overdose. And the video that's on Cape Cod Online as well is extremely compelling to hear this young man now speak and talk about his addiction issues.
Yeah, that's a real conversation starter, you know, for families with children, teenagers, you know, talk about what can happen if you let addiction run your life. Just getting back to this story about what the governor did, he also is allowing police officers now to use to carry Narcan, which if they are called to an overdose, that can save a life. So many of the Cape Cod police departments immediately started carrying that in their cruisers.
Yeah, that can wake someone right up from an overdose. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle, is going to join us. And welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle, will be joining us soon. But first, George, let's talk about Provincetown, where there's an effort to ban single-use plastic bags. This is something we've seen in other areas of the country. We've always predicted it would be coming here, and here it is.
Yeah, this would be the first ban of these plastic bags here on Cape Cod if it's approved at the April 7th town meeting. These are the types of bags you get asked about at Stop and Shop. They ask you paper or plastic. If you say plastic, these are the bags that they give you. And you'll see these things all over the place. And that's what the concern is. And when I say all over the place, I mean all over the place, on the ground, on the trees.
Right.
If you've ever been to the Bourne landfill, which is a pretty good-sized landfill, they take refuse from other towns. There's actually, on the outer trees, they're hanging from the trees there. I mean, it's a real problem, and it, environmentally, if these get into the water, which is
sure,
possible
they do,
here,
yes.
Whales and sea turtles mistake them for their favorite foods, which are jellyfish and squid, kind of look alike, and you know, it causes problems for them.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how that works out, because once one town does it, seems other towns get inclined to do the same thing. Tim Wood is joining us on the phone. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hello, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Thanks for being here. Let's talk about the Outer Cape Health Services. They're expanding.
They're expanding down here in Harwich. The Stonehorse Motor Inn, which is on Route 28 in South Harwich, has been vacant for a number of years, and actually it's one of its buildings burned down in 2012. And now Outer Cape Health Services has a purchase and sales agreement on that 2.6-acre property. Outer Cape Health Services has offices and clinics right now in Wellfleet and Provincetown, and one just down the road from the Stonehorse in Harwich. And what they've proposed is a 30,000 square foot healthcare facility on the property, which would include 20 examination rooms, a pharmacy, urgent care facilities, Health advocates are welcoming this news. There's a critical shortage of primary care doctors on the Lower Cape, particularly those who accept Medicare payments. And Outer Cape is particularly focused on low-income and Medicare patients. The project has yet to undergo any sort of regulatory review by the town. It's really in its early stages, although Outer Cape officials tell us they have a purchase and sales agreement on the property, which is set to close on June 30th. And they're working right now with Congressman William Keating to put together a funding package to purchase the property from involving U.S. Department of Agriculture funds. The next step here is Outer Cape health officials are meeting with stakeholders in Harwich on April 10th. And after that, we hope to get more news about a possible completion date for the project.
Is Outer Cape Health Services separate and distinct from Cape Cod Healthcare?
It is. It's apparently they have a cooperative agreement with Cape Cod Healthcare, but it's a separate nonprofit organization. It's, you know, right now it's one of really only a couple choices you have down here on the Cape, this part of the Cape especially, with for healthcare, because Cape Cod Healthcare controls or owns or has agreements with almost all of the other healthcare providers in this area.
Right. Let's talk about the Harwich Middle School, an affordable housing proposal.
Yes. After the current school year ends, Harwich Middle School will be vacated. The students next September will be going to the new Monomoy Regional Middle School in Chatham. Harwich officials are expecting the school district to turn the vacant property back to the town at that point. Harwich, the town put out a request for proposals for reuse of that property, and they only got one response. It was from Stratford Capital Group of Peabody, and they proposed converting the school to 56 affordable housing units. The plan calls for tearing down a portion of the building, actually the newest portion of the building, renovating the remainder for for apartments, one, two, and three bedroom apartments, and then building 16 townhouses on the what is the current front lawn of the property. Stratford has proposed paying the town $672,000 for the property, which is, by the way, is assessed at $10 million. But the amount seems to be in line with what this company has paid other Cape communities to convert old schools into housing. They paid Yarmouth $563,000 for the Simpkins School, which is being renovated into affordable housing. And they paid Bourne, I think, $400,000 for the Cody School, which is also slated for affordable housing. And town officials in Harwich, they're in the process of reviewing the proposal. They've got a review committee that's looking at it, and they're expected to make a recommendation to the Harwich Board of Selectmen on April 10th.
And they would all be affordable units, not a split?
That's the way the proposal looks right now. They would all be affordable units for folks who make 60% or less of the median income for the county. There was no talk of any market rate units involved in this at all.
Last week, after the blizzard, we were talking about a historic home in Chatham, I believe, that collapsed. And
indeed, the 200-year-old Mallows House in the Chatham's Old Village collapsed under the 70-mile-an-hour winds that we had during the blizzard. The historic house was in the process of being renovated, and plans for the renovation had been approved by the local historical commission and the Cape Cod Commission, since the property is in the Old Village Historic District. The house had been a newer addition had been taken off. The house had been stripped to its bare walls, and according to the architect, the three interior walls that remained were braced against an east wind. Unfortunately, on the day of the blizzard, the wind was from the north. It came in an open side of the building. It actually lifted the structure up off of its foundation and sort of pushed it to the south, and it collapsed. There was a lot of concern because this was one of the sort of the key houses in that historic district, very visible right next to the Coast Guard station. The town officials and the Cape Cod Commission are requiring that the original elements of the house that are not damaged, the beams and the boards, have to be taken out and reassembled to restore the house as close as possible to the original, and the incident sparked a discussion about the renovation of historic houses and how they're often sort of taken right down to the bare walls or the studs and rebuilt. And some people are concerned that there's really no way to monitor that project, that sort of process, at least in Chatham. There's nothing in the regulations or the building code or the zoning bylaw to regulate that. So the Historical Commission is very concerned about that, and they are planning to work with the Building Department to try to develop those guidelines to hopefully prevent something like this happening again.
Okay. Tim, I appreciate it very much. Tim is editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. You can follow him on Twitter at CCC Newsroom. Thank you, Tim. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks, Sean.
Bye-bye. And well, on the phone, no, I think we're going to have Josh Balling join us from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror in just a moment. But George Brennan of the Cape Cod Times is with me in our Woods Hole studio. George, let's talk about medical marijuana again. There are two dispensaries coming to Cape Cod, one in Mashpee, the other one in Dennis. And Dennis is saying, hey, wait, maybe we can get more out of this than property taxes.
That's right. They're looking at a 5% yearly excise tax on these. And there's nothing in the state legislation that allows this at the present time, so they're going to have special legislation passed in order to do this. But they're saying that if they can get this approved, that with what the dispensary says that it's going to take in, that could amount to about anywhere from $155,000 in the first year up to $320,000 a year in year three of this project. They're saying that this money could go to things like policing and public health programs, recreation, those types of things that the town, you know, like any other town, probably doesn't have enough money for at the present time. One of the finance committee members, of course, is saying, hey, let's hold on a minute. Maybe we could actually save this money.
Yeah,
he had an interesting quote. He said, that idea may be foreign to some of you, but, you know, so... But it's an interesting idea, you know, and I guess this is done in other places where medical marijuana has been approved in other parts of the country, this type of an idea of excise tax.
It's interesting to me because presumably this is medical marijuana for people who need it to relieve symptoms of a variety of different diseases and ailments. And so we hear talk about we want to keep the price at a level that it is competitive with the street value. And now we're hearing, well, maybe we can further tax it. And it would seem that all those increased costs will be passed along to the patients.
As they always are, right?
Right, right.
So, you know, but what we've seen in the documents so far, in the projections and those types of things, is that these dispensaries are going to bring in some significant money. The first year, this Dennis facility says it's going to bring in $3.1 million. I mean, I would think that would put it up there with one of the larger businesses in Dennis.
I would imagine so. Joshua Balling is joining us, and he's the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, as well as the director of digital content at the paper. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, town meeting is coming up on Nantucket.
It is.
What's on the agenda?
Morning, a day-long town meeting. Most people are saying hopefully it'll only be one day long, although the last time Nantucket had a one-day town meeting 2 years ago, it extended over into the following Monday by an hour or two. Nantucket's town meetings traditionally have been among the longest and the most articles on the warrant of any town and among the Cape and Islands across New England, as a matter of fact. Tomorrow's warrant has 107 articles up for voter approval. There's more than 30 proposed zoning changes. Approval of the $67 million municipal budget, about $12 million in big-ticket capital spending, a number of interesting proposals, one that would change the makeup of the town's architectural review board, the Historic District Commission, another that would change the town manager's job from an appointed to an elected position, a couple of other things, one asking the town to purchase a piece of property from a number of neighbors who are worried that it's going to be developed, overly developed in the middle of the island. And about $3.3 million in spending in community preservation funds on 18 different projects. There's a lot to keep people busy. Town meeting starts tomorrow at 9 o'clock in the high school auditorium, and it'll go right on until 5 or until all the business is done. If it extends any longer than that by a significant amount, it'll continue on Monday. One of the interesting comments that the town moderator, Sarah Alger, made to us in the story we wrote this week is that town meeting's not like going to the theater. It's more like a baseball game. You don't have to stay rooted in your seats. You can get up. You can stretch your legs. You can get a cup of coffee. Maybe go out for a couple of articles and come back. You know, they want you there. They want you to participate in this form of democracy, but you don't have to stay rooted in your seats the whole day.
Josh, is it open town meeting or elected town meeting?
It is an open town meeting. Nantucket has about 8,500 registered voters. Our turnout has not obviously been anywhere near that in recent years, usually hovering somewhere between 500 and 1,000. One thing that Sarah Alger and some other town officials are concerned about is if tomorrow is a particularly nice day, turnout might not be that great. We haven't seen too many nice days lately, particularly on the weekends, and it might be interesting if there's only a handful of registered voters in the auditorium to decide on some of these pretty important topics.
Right. The scallop season ended this week, and how did things work out on Nantucket?
Things worked out relatively well on Nantucket, all things considered. Nantucket long been considered the last really commercially viable scallop industry, bay scallop industry, left anywhere, really. And given how cold the weather was this winter, how many storms we had, it came out pretty well. 14,500 bushels, give or take, of scallops were harvested since November 1st. That's down about 20% from last year's 18,000 bushels, but quite higher than in some recent years when it hovered below 10,000. And especially when you consider that 26 scalloping days were lost to sub-freezing temperatures since the start of the season back in November, not too bad at all. A couple of initiatives were taken to try and increase the harvest a little bit, given those weather days. Toward the end of the season, the Board of Selectmen allowed scallopers to take one extra bushel per day from 5 to 6 in an effort to increase the harvest a little bit. But one thing they didn't do on Wednesday night was allow an extension of the season by an extra week. The scallopers came in after the season had already closed and asked for permission to do that. And there's a reason town officials say that scallop season ends on April 1st across the state. It's because with the water temperatures changing, the scallop quality goes down quite a bit, and it would affect the quality of the individual scallops and the quality of the brand in general. So they said no to that. But overall, the scallopers we talked to said it was a decent season, a little bit harsher weather out there, but they lived with it. They got paid pretty well, about $15 a pound for the scallops, which is up from $11 or $12 last year, and they were retailing on Nantucket for between $20 and $24 a pound. But a lot of those Nantucket scallops end up on restaurant plates around the country in restaurants, fine dining establishments from San Francisco to Seattle to New York and Washington. So we had our fill here, but they traveled far and wide.
Well, that is good news. It's such an important industry in the winter months for the island. Let's talk about the Marine Mammal Stranding Team on Nantucket. No funding.
No funding for the Marine Mammal Stranding Team. Nantucket's Marine Mammal Stranding Team had been funded for years by the New England Aquarium, and a lot of the work they did in strandings was primarily with seals. The gray seal population, as a lot of people know, has really exploded in and around the Cape and Islands, particularly on Nantucket in the last half decade to decade. And the New England Aquarium, facing its own funding shortages, has changed its strategy on what type of species it really is prioritizing to protect, and is changing that from seals, given the population boom, to endangered sea turtles. And as such, because Nantucket doesn't really deal with that many endangered sea turtles, the aquarium had pulled its funding and put the Nantucket Marine Mammal Stranding Team under the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, which is another level of bureaucracy that they're still trying to work out and figure out how that's best going to work. But this whole issue came to a head this week. There was a injured seal that was seen out at Great Point reported, and the reporting party first attempted to call the aquarium and was told that they're no longer handling it anymore. It was given some information for NOAA and for Marine Fisheries, and it was quite some time before they were able to work through the process, and at that point the seal, which had was entangled in some fishing line, had labored its way back into the ocean. It didn't look like it was really probably going to survive. So with all the seals we have out here, the stranding team is really struggling to try and figure out how they're going to handle some of these strandings. There are very specific rules and regulations about who is allowed to handle, who is allowed to touch, how close you're allowed to get to these marine mammals. Even given that population boom, gray seals are still considered an endangered, threatened species under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. So you're not allowed to go anywhere near them. Lay people, especially even members of the stranding team, have very specific protocols and rules they have to follow, and they really can't do their job without assistance and funding from larger organizations. So it'll be interesting to see what happens moving forward.
Joshua Balling is the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, as well as the director of digital content at the paper. You can follow Josh on Twitter at jballingim. Josh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with me in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan with the Cape Cod Times. George, we've talked in the past about some property owners in Sandwich who've been watching their beach just disappear, and they blame a jetty, I think, with the Cape Cod Canal as being responsible for that, and they want some of their sand back, right?
That's correct. I want you to think for a moment. You have $200,000 in the palm of your hand. You blow on it, and it vanishes.
Hmm.
That's what these people have seen. They've just replaced sand in front of their homes after some storms this fall. And in this blizzard, while we were all worrying about what was going to pile up, they were watching their sand get washed away again. Another 15 feet of sand, some of it that they had just put back, was washed away in that blizzard. And It's a tough situation, and that jetty that was put in when the canal was being built and is now under the control of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, what it does is it traps sand that would naturally replenish the beach on the Scusca Beach side. If you've ever seen an aerial photo of that area, Scuscet Beach has these massive sandbars, and on the other side, the dunes just keep getting more and more devastated by each and every nor'easter that we're hit with.
So this is different than the Outer Cape or Nantucket, where it's just part of the natural process. They're blaming this man-made jetty. What would happen if they removed the jetty? Any speculation there?
Well, if they removed the jetty, White Cliffs, which is in Plymouth, obviously, there's erosion there. It's natural progression. And what happens is the sand would continue to flow, and it would replenish not only Town Neck Beach and Sandwich, but then the sand that gets removed from Town Neck would replenish the beaches further on down in Barnstable and so on. So it does cause problems further down the Cape as well. It's just more exacerbated right there at Town Neck because they're not getting any of that sand anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really a problem. In other parts of the country, what they've done, and I was actually down in Cocoa Beach, and I noticed this project that they were doing down there, and I came back and wrote a story about it because they have the same thing where the cruise ships go out in Cape Canaveral, at Port Canaveral. They put up a jetty there to keep that channel open, and that starves Cocoa Beach. But they have put in place a system where they dredge on the other side, they put the sand out, and then they pump it up onto the beach and move it around and rebuild the dunes periodically so that they can sustain some of the storms that Florida gets. And homeowners here are saying that's what needs to happen here. Now, the town does have a couple of grants that are in the works. These homeowners say we might not have a beach left before these grants get answered.
Nice.
So they're really concerned.
We're going to take just a quick break, and when we come back, Nelson Siegelman is going to join us. He's the managing editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. And welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is George Brennan. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Joining us on the phone is Nelson Siegelman, managing editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, Nelson.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Town meeting. We've been talking about town meeting across the Cape a little bit here. It's coming up in Edgartown, Oak Bluffs, West Tisbury. What are some of the most pressing items?
Well, as always, money is what takes center stage. This is when town voters set their spending blueprints for the coming fiscal year that begins on July 1st. And it's interesting when you think about it. For example, with those three meetings, the voters are going to spend a total of $72 million. And if the past is any guide, probably you'll get about 15% of the electorate showing up. If we look at the three meetings, really Oak Bluffs has two major building projects that they're going to ask voters to fund, a new town hall and a new
fire station, EMS station. So those are two big budget items.
Yeah, that's a lot for one warrant.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. Although Oak Bluffs, after going through a period where their books really were running, they're really cash strapped. They seem to have righted the ship, so to speak. But for education expenses going up, it would only be about a 1% increase in their budget right now. They're fiscally sound, and they're looking ahead to their infrastructure now, and that's part of that. In West Tisbury, the voters are going to take up an operating budget that's up 7%. Again, school expenses account for some of that, and also they just, as we discussed last week, they just opened a brand new public library. It was an expansion of their old library, so the costs for that building have gone up as well. And they're going to take up the Mill Pond debate once again. The people who have visited the vineyard have probably driven by it. It's a very pretty little pond, and there's a debate over whether or not to dredge the pond or let it revert to its natural course and basically recreate the stream that was once there and went down to Tisbury Gray Pond. They had So, at any rate, that's going to be on the docket. Edgartown, everything seems pretty calm in Edgartown from what we hear from one of the selectmen who described the budget and the warrant. But all voters will be taking up a proposal that would put regulations governing fertilizer in place across the vineyard. And communities across the state will be facing these new restrictions, but the Vineyard has upped those a bit to contain phosphorus and nitrogen, which has a damaging effect in our estuaries and on our freshwater bodies. So that will also, I'm sure, be a topic of discussion.
Okay, sounds like great town meetings coming up. Hopefully people will attend them and they'll get the quorums that they need to make some important decisions.
It's going to be a busy night, and you know it's great fun. I have to say, it's always great fun to go to annual town meetings. I mean, it's democracy at its sort of most basic level, and everybody has a chance to speak, and it's always an interesting experience.
Hey, Nelson, take a ferry and cover one of mine.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you, I like them. I mean, each town on the vineyard is different, and Edgartown is always, it's held in the old Wailing Church. It's a model of decorum, and you go to some of the others, and it's like a big family dinner where everybody is just sort of chiming in. So,
all right, catch the show. All right, Nelson Siegelman, Managing Editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. I appreciate the information, Nelson.
Great.
Have a good one. And George Brennan is here in our Woods Hole studio, encouraging Nelson to send reporters over to cover the Cape Cod town meetings. George, let's talk about Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. We heard from the Association to Preserve Cape Cod this week. That's the largest environmental organization on the Cape, weighing in on the growing and continuing controversies surrounding the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station, which, of course, is in Plymouth.
Yeah, they're the latest chiming in and saying that Pilgrim ought to be closed and that the spent fuel rods ought to be put in dry casks. They're joining a chorus that's been out there since the nuclear disaster in Fukushima, Japan, of course, in 2011. They issued this statement to their 5,000 members. I did find it interesting in their statement that of what an accident could, you know, they're saying improbable accidents can occur, and what it could impact, that the human population was last on their list. I might put it on first on the list, but, you know, it can have widespread impacts, as they say, on water resources, fish, wildlife, food, crops. And they're saying that this plant, given its track record, that it's not worth the risk anymore for what it could do to Cape Cod.
Right. And, of course, the governor waded in on this recently as well, being encouraged to write a letter to the NRC opposing the plant, which was fairly recently relicensed for an additional 20 years for a 40-year-old plant. But the governor has said, and numerous people have said, look, not much we can do about it. This is a federal issue, and the federal regulators seem to continue to support Pilgrim and believe, or at least say, that it is safe. Let's move on to East Ham, where there's been ongoing issues with the water there, some toxic elements in the water.
That's right. And one of the ways they're looking to deal with that is to put in a town water system, $45.8 million water system that would hook up as many as more than 2,000 properties. This is going to be on the May 5th town meeting warrant. It needs a two-thirds majority. Mm. Those are sometimes difficult to get. You can sometimes get a majority, but getting that two-thirds majority can be difficult. But they are saying that there's a little bit more support this time around. This is not the first time that they've brought this issue to voters, but they're saying there's more support now. There is also the promise, or the possibility, I should say, of state help here. And if that happens, it would lower the amount that taxpayers would have to fund this project significantly. It would almost cut it in half, and that would make it more palatable. One of the state reps, Sarah Peek, is saying that the town should know about that sometime in mid-April. So it's before town meeting. That could help with the upcoming vote. Meanwhile, they're still dealing with this toxin. It's 1,4 dioxin, and it's been found by the Environmental Protection Agency as a probable human carcinogen. You know, it's been found in some private wells. It's affecting a couple of public buildings at this point where they have to bring in bottled water. So this is a major issue in East Ham.
A new report came out. I believe there's an article about it in the Cape Cod Times today about climate change, and Barnstable County was prominent.
That's right. This particular study looked at a bunch of different areas in New England, but the only place it looked at in Massachusetts was Barnstable. But they're saying that this we should take heed all over Cape Cod, because the same situation faces all Cape towns because of our environment here. And it was done by in conjunction with MIT and also Wacoit Bay National Estuarian Research Reserve, we know as WEBNR here. And essentially what they're saying is those nice, cool summer nights that we enjoy here mm-hmm. on Cape Cod, maybe a thing of the past, mm-hmm. that you know, some of the erosion we talked about earlier is just going to get worse and worse with climate change and sea level rise. And it's a major concern. The projections for Barnstable are that our temperatures will rise between 2.9 and 6.4 degrees in the next century. And that the greatest warming influence will be in those temperatures overnight. You know, so we like those cool nights here on
Cape Cod. And that's why many of us don't have central air conditioning, because the nights are so cool. You can just open the windows, nice breeze comes through. If it starts to warm up, people are going to be installing more air conditionings, and that's even perpetuating the problem. Let's talk about the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe. George covers the casino issue, and of course, the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe is seeking a casino. How about a quick update on that, and then let's talk about the tribe's new community center.
Well, yesterday, the Gaming Commission, the Massachusetts Gaming Commission, extended the deadline for commercial casinos in southeastern Mass. Many of those potential developers are telling the commissioners, look, with the Mashpee Wampanoag still in the picture, we're having difficulty getting funding. There's a lot of other market influences here in southeastern Mass. Of course, the commission put the slot parlor in Plainville. That's in southeastern Mass. Mm-hmm. There's already casinos in Rhode Island. There's casinos nearby within 2 hours of Cape Cod in Connecticut. And these developers are saying, we need a little break here. They're also asking for a reduction in the $500 million minimal investment that the state requires. They're not suggesting to go much below that. They want certain things included, like a lot of the money that they have to pay for mitigation and things like that. So the commission said yesterday that they would extend the deadline at least until September 23rd, but they're going to look at it again in a couple of weeks, and they may even extend it further. One comment by Chairman Crosby may have sent shockwaves through southeastern Mass. He said he's not sure that time is going to help unless they know what's going to happen with the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe Casino. Time may not help because investors may not be willing to fund some of these commercial casinos with the tribe still in the picture.
And, of course, the tribe is waiting for the federal government to make a decision about whether it can put land into trust, and that's where they would open the casino.
Taunton. That's correct. They're looking for that in Taunton. They've gotten some positive news recently, not particularly on their specific application, but that some of the things that they've told the federal government about their application applies. So they're still waiting for the BIA. It's a federal process. It takes time. One of the things Crosby said is, well, if we extend the deadline out, at least we're that much closer to maybe hearing a decision.
Has anyone speculated about what would happen to the tribe if they do not get the casino? Do they owe money to investors, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, much of the money that they've borrowed to pre-plan this casino is it's at an interest rate that none of us would ever want to pay. I've heard upwards of 25% that they would owe.
But it's hard to know exactly.
It's hard to know exactly, yeah. Because the tribe doesn't have to report
such
things.
Yeah.
They're under no obligation to anybody other than their members to report.
Okay. Let's quickly move to a big weekend for the tribe. I mean, this community center or government center, what are they calling it? And just reading about what it includes is remarkable. It's worth taking a drive down to see it.
Yeah, it's both a community and a government building. Mm-hmm. It has an impressive gym in it that can be used by the children of the Mashpee Wampanoag for basketball games and their cheerleading and gymnastics and those types of activities. And it is an impressive looking building.
Yeah, sure is.
And many of the you live in Mashpee, so you see their bumper stickers, and one of their famous lines is Mashpee Wampanoag Pride. And this gives them tremendous pride. This building, where they're calling it a gathering place. It's both for their government offices, but it's not just that. It's where they can go, and the elders have a place to meet there. They're going to have a food pantry there, which is very important to the people, the Mashpee Wampanoag people. And so many of the people who were quoted in this story talked about, we finally have a place to gather, to get together, and be one. So
the tribe has had so many challenges. So many members have had to leave the region because it's just become so expensive. You drive through town and you notice that there are multiple people living in one home just so they can stay in Mashpee, stay among their other family members and tribe members. And I was there. I think you were there when they got their federal recognition. It was such a great, important day for them, and they saw this coming, and I can totally understand why they'd be so full of pride and happy to have their own place. And you're right, it is impressive. A waterfall inside, is that right?
Yeah, and the architecture outside that kind of looks like a turtle, which is their symbol. It's an impressive looking building, and I think it rivals, any town hall we have here on Cape Cod.
I would say so. George Brennan, thank you so much for coming in. He is a reporter with the Cape Cod Times. He joined us in our Woods Hole studio. Thanks, George.
Thank you.
And thanks to our other contributors, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Joshua Balling, who called in from the newsroom at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and of course, Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. And thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.
The Friday News Roundup on The Point is produced by Sean Corcoran. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.